Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Hey, greetings, folk. Happy May and welcome to the Fallon Forum. Thanks to our local small business partners, including Gateway Marketing Cafe, David Drake Family Psychiatry, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Hey, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. And I am delighted to welcome to the program Liana Elliott. She's the former New Orleans Department Chief of Staff for Mayor Cantrell. Back when was that, Liana?
I served Mayor Cantrell 2018 until 2022.
All right. So post-Katrina.
Very post-Katrina, very recently, ish. Yes. Yeah. Recently, I've seen it all.
Yeah. And so you've also seen the story in The Guardian about how New Orleans people just need to pack up and leave because with climate the way it's going, New Orleans is not going to exist in the fairly near future. So I'm sure you've got your bags all ready to go. You're probably driving out of town right now, maybe moving to Iowa. I don't know.
Right. I have to unstick my eye roll first to be able to focus on the road if I were to drive anywhere. This is a moment that happens frequently in New Orleans where we are told all of a sudden, hey, guess what? New Orleans is sinking and it's not a viable city and everybody should leave. As if it's news, which is not news to us. Apparently, it is still news to others out in the world. But no, it is not news to us. And it's also not news in that we're not the only city that's facing this. There's a lot of cities that are out there, a lot of population communities, towns, hamlets that are in harm's way of climate change. Sure. So, you know, every once in a while we get singled out. We get, you know, told that our way of life is ridiculous and unsustainable and that everybody needs to just pick up and relocate as if you could pick up a whole city and a culture away from a historic place and like recreate it somewhere else.
So
it's hilarious.
There have been efforts to relocate small villages along the Alaskan coast inland from, you know, away from where the erosion is occurring, but that's different.
Yes. We've also had the first climate refugees in the United States were in Louisiana as well. Several years ago, there's some really fabulous movies out there too about folks living out in the bayou in these little fishing towns, because this is a statistic that every school child here knows, but I'm assuming most listeners don't. Louisiana loses a football field of land every hour. And I know that seems insane.
That's hard to imagine. I mean,
I know it is, but it is really real. Wow. And one of our favorite things to do is take an airboat tour out into the bayou. And these guys who are these like real thick Cajun accents, fishermen, multiple generations, always lived out over, you know, in the water, they'll show you where their house used to be. And it's just in the middle of water, of open water. And, mm-hmm. you know, they tell stories about what it used to be like. And, you know, you can see the pilings and those are the pilings from my best friend's house that I used to walk over to now. And now it's, you know, very much in the middle of open water.
You talk about a couple of movies that reference this transition, and is one of them Beast of the Southern Wild?
Yes, that is.
I love that movie. That is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And I think it's, you know, it shows really what it's like that down here, that this is really real. And there are communities that have already lost their way of life. And, you know, New Orleans is just the big shiny one that is kind of next.
Yeah.
So to speak.
And so you don't deny the climate science that's saying, Louisa, that New Orleans is in trouble.
Not at all. And I think, you know, to be fair, and, you know, I've joked with you about this, that, you know, the timing of this is always suspicious. Every spring we get these, you know, seasonal articles where somebody has been sent on assignment to New Orleans suspiciously right after Mardi Gras or festival season. An article comes out about how we are sinking and everybody needs to move or whatever the thing is. It also happens right after the Katrina anniversary. So in August, we tend to get those. as well. So that sort of suspicion aside about why the timing of this is questionable. Legitimately, there is a paper that was just recently published from some local climate science. I'm not sure what their specialties are, but anyways, but they're really smart people that are actually believing in science and doing the hard, good work of documenting what is happening. That part is to some extent newsworthy because there is something that we can point to now, and I think that should and could have implications for policies, for the way that we can point to something and say there's evidence here, this is not climate conspiracy. Now, whether or not that means the implication is that everybody ought to be picking up and moving is somewhat hilarious. And I would love to point your listeners to this article that my very, very close friend Christopher Ard wrote in The Lens New Orleans, which is it's a great piece in response to the Guardian article,
I
where he
read it,
kind of
yeah.
goes through a lot of these points and sort of explains a little bit about, how we feel about being sort of redlined as the city, just like you are not viable, so goodbye. And but we're still here. There's still a thriving community of 360,000 people here.
But
But
down
we've
from
been,
what? 600,000 years ago, yeah.
exactly. So the 1960 census for New Orleans was about 660,000 people, and they estimated that was going to just grow and grow and grow for the oil and gas boom. And the 1970 census showed that we were very wrong. So a lot of things happened in the interim. Integration happened, white flight happened, and a lot of these suburban, GI Bill towns kind of popped up all over the region, and our population started dropping at that point. So our epoch was really the mid-1960s. Pre-Katrina, we were a little over 400,000. The 2020 census, we were really hoping we were going to get back to that 400,000, and we didn't. We're still losing population. So that is also nothing new. The regular life forces are already pushing people out. It's a very difficult place to live. We often say it's a great place to visit. It's a difficult place to live. The infrastructure is very, very old. It is failing. It has not been invested in. It rains harder than it used to. It's hotter than it used to be. All of those things. The insurance is crazy expensive. So all of these forces have already been doing that work, sort of somewhat organically. And the idea that there's some magic royal we that could move a city is just not how this works. And even if that were even a realistic possibility, there are so many people here that just they can't leave. They wouldn't leave. They don't want to leave.
Well,
And we have
Chris, the Chris Ard, the guy wrote the article. He said he was 11th generation New
yeah,
Orleans.
his father's side traces his roots back to 1718, which is the founding of the city of New Orleans.
Wow.
So it's, and he jokes in the article a little bit about having to go to birthday parties in East Houston, which is a joke name for Baton Rouge. But, the family has scattered, right? That it's like it's not, you don't walk down the street to your cousin's house anymore. You got to get in the car and you got to drive. And that is not the way it used to be in the city.
Well, New Orleans certainly isn't the only city in the U.S. that's losing population for one reason or another. I remember when I walked across the country and came to Youngstown. I mean, the population loss in Youngstown, I can't remember what it was, but it is it was at that point the fastest declining city of a certain size in the U.S. I think more significant declining population than New Orleans. And here in Iowa, we have 99 counties. We've seen a slight rise in population from 3 million to 3.2 million. But you want to guess how many of our 99 counties are losing population?
Most of them?
69.
Yep.
So
Yeah.
only 30 have seen any gain in population. So I mean, this is a big problem across the country, and for different
It
reasons.
is.
Different
It
reasons,
is.
but
And it's, Ed, it's global. It's happening all over the world. And Chris also mentioned several cities that are, London, for example, Mexico City, Rio, San Francisco, LA. It is happening, lest we forget about our cousin Venice in Italy, that's already been dealing with the Acqua Altas for decades. That this is not unique to New Orleans. And so that's, I guess, part of where we're a little in our feelings about being singled out about this.
Why?
We are just one of the older cities in the city, so our infrastructure is that much older, but we're just what's to come for a lot of other cities that have exactly the same problems that we face. We're just a little bit ahead of the curve.
Canary in the coal mine.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what do you do about it?
That is really the better question that we should be asking. And I think that's kind of the response also that Chris puts in the article that I'm really resonated with me deeply is just telling us that our city is sinking and the sea is approaching. That is not That's not helpful. Like we, well, I mean, like, thank you. We know that. We are very super duper aware of that already. But what do you do about that is a much better question, right? Are the policy implications of that that you no longer invest in infrastructure, or that you no longer invest in jobs programs or attract businesses to come down here? You don't fix your house if it breaks? Like, no, it's not that imminently existential. So there is a gray area that we have to find here as a society in terms of what we're willing to invest in, and also just sort of as local, municipal, parish, state government, what are we willing to do? And Ed, that's the terrifying part, because our state government is not in a position to be making any of those kinds of decisions in a way.
I see it's on the verge of eliminating the only majority African American district in the amongst U.S. congressional delegation.
Yes, I mean, pick a thing. Louisiana is having some major crises around it. The congressional district is one of them. They're also trying to eliminate a seat for clerk of criminal district court that is just been recently been inaugurated. This really wonderful gentleman who was exonerated and went to law school and became an attorney and won fair and square this election to be elected into this position, and now the state legislature is trying to take steps to eliminate that entire office. Like, you name it, we've got shenanigans.
How did they get away with that?
Oh, that's a whole other situation. But these are the things that I think the rest of the country are starting to experience, because this has been the playbook in Louisiana for decades. We've been dealing with this kind of shenanigans and these crazy ideas of, climate science deniers and stuff like that. That's not new for us at all. Having state overreach into local government so that, some massively inequitable outcome happens, or something that completely denies science. So the governor just canceled a $3 billion sediment diversion project that would have helped to rebuild the wetlands that everybody, bipartisan, thought was a good idea.
Did
And
he
suddenly he
really?
decided it was too expensive. Yeah.
And the legislature didn't override his veto?
No, this is a different, it's coming from these from settlement funds from the oil and gas litigation, because he wants to keep that industry happy. It's a mess, right? But again, guys, we're not unique. Like, there are many things that you can find only in New Orleans, like our food, our music, our architecture, all that. But these kinds of shenanigans are countrywide right now, and these problems around climate disasters are imminent globally. And having a conversation just about New Orleans and being like, oh, well, that one tiny town or whatever, that's not productive, because so many other people are in harm's way. And I often like to remind folks, our same Army Corps of Engineers built the levees that protect all of LA County's drinking water, that built our same levees that failed catastrophically. That's 13 million people that could be without drinking water. That's not something to just like shake your head and shrug about, right? We know there are going to be these catastrophes that are coming from man-made climate change. We know there's catastrophes that are like earthquakes that are just going to happen, and we're woefully unprepared for how we as a society want to respond to that kind of a crisis.
There's no place that doesn't have some level of impact from climate change. I think coastal communities are probably top of the list, and maybe close behind or on a par are the wooded areas out west where the wildfires have been worse than ever. The wildfire season longer than ever. But even here in Iowa, where we're insulated from those two issues, we've seen derechos that are like a tornado, but instead of being only a block wide or less than a block wide, it's 20 miles wide, and it's a problem. And we're
Yeah.
also seeing a very and a very exacerbated cycle of drought and flooding, and we've had a lot of drought. This year has been wetter than usual, actually a nice level of wet, but we also seen some pretty impressive flooding too. So no place is safe from the
No
increased
place is safe.
advancements of climate change.
Exactly. And honestly, we've also, this is part of the sort of growth mindset of America that we need to start getting ourselves away from, that this like manifest destiny cities always grow. That's not true, and we've known that throughout history. I'm an urban planner by training, and it's like there is a death of a city that happens. We've seen that in small towns already, in company towns, when the company, packs up and leaves or goes out of business. That is a normal, natural part of a life cycle of a place, and that's not something we talk about. We always just assume it's more and more and more, and growth and growth and growth, and we've never had to sort of have this hard conversation around, like, what do you do when that future is very much not only not guaranteed, but all but likely bleak.
One of my big focus areas as a lawmaker years ago was urban planning, and I remember I could not get through to the your average city planner would always say, "Well, if you don't grow, you die." And I was thinking, well, you know, if you, I mean, if
That's
you know,
called cancer.
well,
Nothing
exactly,
grows
I would
forever.
say that. That's pretty much what I would say, you know, or you know, when I would stop physically growing when I was 19 or so, but hopefully I continue to grow, you know, intellectually, emotionally, you know, spiritually. There's other ways to grow other than continuing to expand your girth.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's what we've seen with sprawl and all kinds. You know, like there's the metaphors abound. I think it's just we do have this 100-year levee protection that's around this federal levee protection that's around the New Orleans metropolitan area, which is about 1.3 million people, which is not a ton. That's like a neighborhood in some areas, right? But that will help for a while. And what we as New Orleanians are generally enjoying what we have while we have it, knowing that it's not going to be here and tomorrow is not guaranteed. But these kinds of conversations around like everybody needs to pick up and leave, or we need to be thinking about relocation, that I hear that in a very meta sense. And that doesn't mean anything for actual people's lives. It doesn't mean anything as a policymaker or a leader or for any level of government or community. Like, what do you mean by that, you know?
Well, Leanna, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. This is a good conversation, and hopefully there'll be a response to the Guardian and any other publication that wants to just paint the situation in the way that they have. So
Yes,
good for
please talk about another city other than us, for crying
you.
out loud.
Folks,
Thanks
we've been
so much
talking
for
with
having
Leanna
me.
Elliott, and when we come back from a short break, Mark Allen Derry is going to join us. We're going to be talking about the Hunter virus. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. 15 cars and 15 restless riders, three conductors, 25 sacks of mail.
Thanks to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Goodbye, Joe. We gotta go.
Hey, welcome back to the Fallon Forum. And thanks for our local small business partners, including Gateway Marketing Cafe and Western Optometry. Hey, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Mark Allen Derry. He and I go way back. Mark Allen's an infectious disease physician. His work is kind of focused on addressing healthcare disparities through initiatives in social, environmental, and economic and racial justice. He served with the World Health Organization in Sierra Leone. That was during the Ebola outbreak. And he's also trained Ukrainian healthcare workers in trauma care. Because that's not enough to keep one guy busy, Mark Allen is also the founder and director of 102.3 FM Radio, WHIV, a station that airs this program. Mark Allen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's glad. I'm very happy to be back.
So we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff today. We're going to start with this Hantavirus situation. which has a lot of people scared, thinking, oh no, COVID
Yes.
2 is coming. And you're an infectious disease physician, so you've got kind of a probably a more scientific perspective on this than some might.
Yes. So first off, let me just say COVID-2 is likely coming, but it's not going to be this Hunta, and it's not anytime soon likely. And in fact, if we want, we could put a pin and talk about what in this segment, talk about the H5N1 bird flu virus that's circulating right now that we're not hearing much about. And I think it's important, and I think in the context of where I'd like to kind of draw some threads together, which is, kind of the US public health care system, which I think is failing, and it's largely failing by the folks at the top who are purposely kind of pushing us in that direction.
We
But
are
that's
hearing.
ultimately where I think we should end up, because I think.
Okay. And we are hearing about bird flu in Iowa because we've had tens of
Go ahead.
thousands of confinement birds die because of it.
Good. Okay.
But.
There was a really fascinating study that came out in California last week, but I'll kind of loop around here to that.
Hey, can we
So
go?
essentially, the hantavirus.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we start with just
Go
defining
ahead.
what is the. My impression is hantavirus is caused primarily by mice.
So the hantavirus is a virus. It's a group of viruses. Imagine like a Ford or a Toyota, of which there are many other, that's the grouping, that's the name of the family. And then there's multiple other viruses in that iteration of hantavirus. So the US has a hantavirus. It's found mostly in the West. So it was first discovered in 1992, 1993 on the Navajo reservation. And that virus is called the sin nombre virus, the virus without a name, so-called because the Navajo people, after the outbreak occurred, did not want it to be called the Four Corners virus, because that would stigmatize
Sure.
the Four Corners and affect tourism. So they ended up calling it sin nombre. So this particular virus, as all of them do, this virus is called the Andes virus, which is found mostly in Chile and Argentina. And this virus likely started in Argentina. It does cause very serious illnesses, kind of like what Ebola causes. These mortality rates are quite high. Hantavirus causes two distinct illnesses. One, that's the cardiopulmonary syndrome, which affects the heart and the lungs, and one that affects the kidneys. Both of them have mortality rates between 40 to 50%. And what we are seeing right now is there's three deaths, eight cases with three deaths. So we're seeing something that resembles more like 40-ish percent or so. And so the thing about the virus is that it affects the insides of the blood vessels, and the inside of the blood vessels are called endothelial cells, and it attacks those cells. When it attacks those cells, it makes the vessels very leaky. So you end up getting a fluid in your lungs, or you can get the hemorrhagic syndrome where you could bleed into various parts of your body as well. It also affects the kidneys. So all this to say, this is a very serious illness. It has a very high mortality rate. So going back to what you had said, that you thought that this was transmitted by mice or rodents, and it is. Again, the US was first alerted to this in 1992. I was in public health school at the time, and we saw it in the deer mice in living on the Navajo reservation. That year was it was an El Nino year in which there was heavy rains that were brought to the areas. Consequently, those rains led to a higher piñon seeds. So there was, because of the extra rains, you got extra vegetation. And because of this extra vegetation, it was able to carry a heavier load of rodents that particular year, because there was more food for the rodents. And then consequently, the rodents and humans interacted, and there you got transmission of the hantavirus through the droppings of the deer mice. So in this case now, and in fact, I took care of several cases of hantavirus when I did my public health service payback on the Navajo reservation some 10 years later. So there I was as a public health student studying it. Little did I knew that the next outbreak that would occur would be on my watch. And I actually diagnosed the first case. Nobody believed me. but she ended up being confirmed by the CDC as having a hantavirus.
What
there
year
were
was
six
that?
cases that year. This was in 2005, 2005,
2005.
2006.
Now, it was,
Yeah.
I first became aware of the disease in, it had to be late 90s, early 2000s, believe it or not, because I was driving through a small town in rural Iowa, Gladbrook, and I had just happened to, I took a break, and I just thought I'd pick up the newspaper, bought a paper, and I read a heartbreaking story about an 11-year-old boy in the town of Gladbrook who had died because of exposure to the mouse droppings, the article said. I felt so bad about it. I wrote the family a letter. And actually, interesting story, but years later, they wrote back, and it was we kind of established a little bit of a connection. But that was my first awareness of it. And so maybe it had moved beyond the Southwest, even as early as, like I said, late 90s, early 2000s.
Sure. I mean, in an area where there is that particular mouse that carries the virus, the C. nominate virus, it's areas that are dusty, dry. You would think of it as, areas like barns or garages or attics. So this is why we tell people, if you're living in that area, be sure to wear PPE, gloves, mask, N95 mask, that sort of respirators, that sort of stuff. Remember, this is also the same virus that that the wife of Gene Hackman was found
right, sure.
dead with, right? Right? So she had been exposed to it and passed. And of course, Gene Hackman had been so was needed so much care at that point in his life that he wasn't able to alert any authorities that she had passed. And then he wasn't able to care for himself, obviously. And he passed away soon afterwards as
so
well.
What caused the people on the cruise ship to
So, okay. So this is where, at this point, this leads to, this is why I say there is a notable dearth of leadership here in the US and at the CDC. And we don't know exactly what happened. At this point, in any other outbreak, we would have a much better idea of what happened. So I'm going to preface this part of the segment by saying, right now, a lot of what I'm about to say is, I'm going to kind of temper each comment with this is speculation versus this is what we know. Okay, so what I'm about to say now is speculation. What we do know is that there was an index case of a couple. That couple was bird watching. They were bird watching, and I've heard this several different ways. Were they bird watching prior to boarding the ship in Argentina, or were they already on the ship? Excuse me. And then they started bird watching. And so we don't know, because that's very significant, because if they were bird watching ahead of time and then they entered the cruise and then there was transmission, that's one form of transmission versus if they were with other people who were bird watching with them. And, as if they were already on the cruise, they, these are one of these cruises that these are like high excursion cruises. In other words, every day you're encouraged. In fact, you do this cruise so that you can do these very off the beaten track sort of experiences or excursions. And so I don't know if the bird watching was part of the excursion as part of the cruise, or were they just bird watching ahead of time?
So it's not just also, it's not just mice that can cause this.
It's rodents.
Rodents. So how do the rodents fit into that scenario?
Well, that's a much deeper, and it would take me an hour. And I would love to have an hour of your time to explain how to define what is truly an infection, because what you're asking now is really a fundamental infectious diseases question. But suffice it to say that we know that animals, bats in the form of Ebola, with COVID, we know, or even with SARS-CoV-1, that there's an intermediary animal that does not get sick from that virus. That every virus has to have a host, right? A virus can't exist on its own in the environment. There has to be a host to host that virus. It's almost like a kind of a parasite, if you will, to a certain degree. And so in this case, the hantavirus, all the different hantaviruses around the world all use some form of a rodent as its vector, as its intermediary, if you will, before it jumps species. And in this case, when it jumps species, it causes death, or it has a high mortality rate to humans. It causes very profound illness.
Yeah. Which sounds like that's what's happening on the cruise ship.
So, so, but here's the tricky thing, is that prior to this Andes species, like, listen, I've spent years, decades studying viruses, and you can't memorize every virus. You can't, like, I know the big classifications, but depending on where you are in the world, there's different iterations of that virus.
Sure.
And so if you'd asked me a week and a half ago, is hantavirus transmitted person to person, that would have been a hard no. That would have been like, no, that is definitely not how hantavirus is transmitted. It's definitively transmitted from rodent droppings that get aerosolized when you're sweeping or what have
Good.
you. It aerosolizes, and then you inhale those aerosolized particles. That's the dried particles where the virus is.
And how about
But in
now?
this case, what
Yeah.
we're this is truly something that is unusual for us. This is a new, it's not new, but the Andes virus was known, but it wasn't. If you were not in Argentina, or if you're not studying this in Argentina or Chile, you're not going to necessarily know. But here's the kicker. The kicker is we don't know what that transmissibility is. The only one article that we have that we know that is in a notable journal about the Andes virus, this hantavirus, is a study in which there was a man who attended a birthday party in Argentina. He was febrile. He was having fever, so presumably he was symptomatic. And he was able to transfer to infect 34 other people at this party, even in areas and people that he didn't necessarily hug that were kind of nearby. So this was likely a super spreader event.
So
This is
34 people
not
got.
a typical thing that happens with this.
So 34
Got
people got
Hunta.
sick. Wow. Okay.
Yes, right. So he was able to infect, obviously inadvertently, but we refer to that as the R naught, the reproductive number. If one person has it, how many other people would get it? This is a highly unusual situation. That is not the typical thing with this virus. This virus, for example, measles has an R naught of like 12 to 18. One person can infect between 12 to 18 people. A COVID at one point had an R naught of 9 and 10, but now the R naught is like 2 or 3. HIV has an R naught of like 2 or 3. This Andes species typically has an R naught of 0.8 to 1.2.
So,
But what we are seeing is much greater transmission rates than the R naught would predict.
I've only got a little time left here, but the on this segment, what is the risk of this becoming a much more serious health concern at this point?
Very little, very little, because
Okay.
that R naught is so small. That R naught, the thing with COVID is the R naught was much greater. And because it was much greater, it had a greater R naught, and that virus also was mutating pretty rapidly. And so we were always trying to keep ahead of it. This virus does not have that same R naught. Also, the COVID virus is transmitted through person to person through a respiratory route, whereas this virus is not necessarily transmitted person to person through the respiratory route. It's likely through touch. But there's a lot that we don't know. And this kind of goes back to that the when the RF when RFK became the head of the Health and Human Services, HHS, he kind of, one of the things that he did is he kind of doged a lot of CDC. I think a third of the employees were unfortunately doged. And with that, part of the expertise that left were kind of these cruise ships, these experts that do these cruise ship outbreak evaluations. And so we just aren't getting the information from the CDC that we need. I anticipate, Ed, that we will learn more and more as time goes on. But I think the big takeaways are this is not going to be another COVID. Hunta is not going to be another COVID. That is something that we're not going to see. It is a scary disease, but unless you were on that cruise ship or you are with somebody, like somebody on that cruise ship lives with you, because we're now starting to see Americans come home, they're actually being sent to a containment unit in Nebraska.
And is there another a big takeaway from this? Or is that it,
I think
primarily?
that no, that's kind of the big takeaway
Okay.
from this as well. I think the other, just to kind of wrap that up real quickly, as how we started, is that really one of the main currencies in public health is that trust. Trust is a major currency. And what we are seeing is this degradation of trust. And when you don't have somebody like the CDC who's upfront talking to us every day, and they are giving us very clear kind of information as to what is happening, especially why do we not know more about these transmission that is happening on the cruise, as well as when people are leaving the cruise ship on planes and when they're going home. We need to know more about this so that we understand more about it. But essentially, we're seeing a degradation of trust, and I think it's going to take generations in the US to rebuild that trust.
Hey, Mark Allen, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, folks, Dr. Mark Allen Derry, an infectious disease physician working in New Orleans. And we're going to talk about an article you wrote about healthcare and Medicaid that I think is really timely and really important when we come back from a short break on the Fallon Forum. Thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Circle of Peacemakers, formerly the Catholic Peace Ministry. Circle of Peacemakers works with people of all faiths toward a world without war. CPM opposes runaway military spending while domestic needs go unmet. Instead of endless wars, CPM supports diplomacy. Visit circleofpeacemakers.com. At Westrum Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrum and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrum's primary concern. Dr. Westrum and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks again to our local small business partners, including Gateway Marketing and Cafe, Architecture by Synthesis, and Story County Veterinary Clinic. Mark Allen, welcome back to the program, folks. Mark Allen Derry, infectious disease physician, has been with us for this part of the conversation. And you wrote recently, I have been fortunate to open several Ryan White Part A clinics in New Orleans, providing free high quality care to people with living with HIV. The Ryan White Part A program is a vital lifeline, offering essential medical and support services to low-income, uninsured, and underinsured individuals living with HIV. Crucially, it also ensures access to care for undocumented people who often have nowhere else to turn for treatment. Thanks to this program, many people living with HIV can consistently take antiretroviral medications, remain virally undetectable, stay healthy, and continue contributing to the economic engine of our country while supporting their families. Sounds like a good program. My impression is, though, is that it is in trouble given the recent legislative and efforts of the U.S. Congress and the president.
Yes, 100%. Unfortunately, with this so-called Big Beautiful Bill, of which almost $1 trillion are going to be cut from Medicaid, kind of going along our last segment about how we are seeing this kind of constant degradation of the good things that work in our society. Last segment, we were talking about public health. Here, we're going to talk about direct health of the public, which is in the form of Medicaid. And so the Ryan White program was really a program that kind of was born out of the 80s, in which I'm sure you probably remember that the president then, President Reagan, refused to kind of acknowledge HIV. It was like kind of hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil sort of thing, in which if they just, they wished it away, kind of like how the current president probably feels about Iran war right now. If you just wish it away or just pretend this, that, or whatever about it, that it'll come true. But that's not the case. You know, in the 80s, it disproportionately affected people who were men who had sex with men. It disproportionately affected people who use heroin. The so-called, you know, the three H's of HIV was heroin, homosexuals, and Haitians and Black people, particularly people from Haiti. There was, I'm sure you probably remember, there was a lot of kind of stigma and real strong homophobia things that were happening in those days. But the fourth age, which kind of emerged in the late 80s, were hemophiliacs. And one particular hemophiliac that emerged, hemophilia is a disease in which your body doesn't produce clotting factors, essentially. So what they were able to do is kind of chemically create a clotting factor, and hemophiliacs around the world rejoiced because now they would get these transfusions of these clotting factors, and it allowed them to live lives, normal kind of lives where they just wouldn't bump into something and potentially risk, or falling and hitting their heads and particularly risk bleeding to death, But
Right.
what was clear, but there was no action taken on it, and that's a whole other conversation, was HIV that was transmitted through the bloodstreams or through these transfusions, through the blood, and in this case, these clotting factors. And so the hemophilia really quite H HIV really kind of kind of eliminated a generation of hemophiliacs. It's quite rare to meet anybody who kind of lived through that time. One of those people was a young man named Ryan White. I don't know if you remember him. He was 15 or 16. He kind of developed HIV. He got kicked out of his high school in Indiana. His family had to move to Florida. And then, of course, it became a cause célèbre where you had Michael Jackson and Elton John and all these individuals who kind of really kind of stood in his corner. And so the Ryan White Care Act kind of was developed in the 90s after he died is kind of like we're going to use these monies and we're going to protect anybody who's living with HIV. And that time that was including people who are undocumented. Flash forward several, a generation and a half from now, and these monies now are at risk because there was never really quite enough money, just like anything else in the US. They don't, when it's something good, it doesn't give you 100% of it. It may give you like 70%, 75%, but it was enough that we're a scrappy group, the HIV world, and we were able to make it work and we were able to kind of get people by with what we had. Then once, 35 or 40 states or however many states expanded Medicaid, we were able to get all these people off Ryan White and get them into expanded Medicaid. And they were able to get their HIV medicines in this HIV kind of with states that expanded Medicaid. Louisiana was one of those states. A lot of the other southern states didn't. Louisiana did. So what we are seeing now is that leaves. Because undocumented people and New Orleans has a very large Honduran population because of the banana trade between Honduras and New Orleans, port cities, or at least Honduras being a country that had port cities, they delivered their bananas to New Orleans and then that got moved throughout the country. We have a large Honduran population here, and of those Hondurans, some of them are undocumented. And so we were able to keep those undocumented people on Ryan White, so they were able to access these treatments that are life-saving, and that also keeps the HIV virus in check because when your viral load is undetectable, you don't transmit HIV. You can engage in unprotected intercourse with your partner or partners and not transmit HIV to anybody. It's really quite incredible the work that has been done with HIV. Now, what we are concerned about, and what I wrote in this article, was this notion that as $800 billion, almost $1 trillion, are being cut from Medicaid in this so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, we are going to see people living with HIV get kicked off the Medicaid rolls. And now they're going to get back onto the Ryan White rolls. And also, at the time that I wrote that article, we were seeing just very oppressive laws that are being passed for people who are undocumented. And so, what I wrote was about a patient of mine that I nicknamed Ramon. I didn't use his real name. And Ramon is this kind of a really is a symbol of all people who are undocumented living with HIV in New Orleans because they are sustaining themselves on Ryan White. But we suspect one that there are going to be laws that are going to make it so that undocumented people are not going to be able to access Ryan White dollars, which means that now they're faced with these horrific kind of choices. The medication that keeps people alive here in the US is mostly are a number of drugs. There's one that I use particularly in my clinic. It costs $2,000 to $3,000 a month. Ryan White dollars pay for that. My patient can't afford that. What person can in today's society afford a medication that's $2,000 or $3,000 a month? This is out of reach out of most working class Americans, out of most Americans. But in Honduras, where he's from, that same medication, not the generic, the same medication costs $5.
Well,
by
really?
comparison, yes.
So this is just another example of the greed of the pharmaceutical company.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And Part D. This is Medicare Part D, where George
yeah.
Bush kind of shackled the American government and made it so they were not able to negotiate drug prices like the rest of the world does, right? The rest of the world. That's why you have people in the northern part of the U.S. that go to Canada to get their medications because they're much
so
cheaper.
Yeah, I know. So Bush did that, but subsequent Democratic presidents didn't do anything to change it.
Agreed. 100% agree, because
yeah.
as you know as well as I do, that these donations, the donors, the drug companies, as well as oil, are the largest sponsors. They donate the most to these political campaigns.
Is this part of what you refer in the title of your article? You refer to the Imperial Health Boomerang.
So that's exactly what I was I was just about to move into.
All right.
So Amil Cesaire is a brilliant kind of political scientist in the 50s. He's from he was born and raised in the Caribbean and was educated and really is a brilliant political scientist. And what he kind of coined this term of the Imperial Boomerang. And the Imperial Boomerang kind of documents that colonizing countries and their very repressive tactics, their very highly militarized or policing tactics, oftentimes boomerang back to the country of origin. And so, you know, if you think about what happened in the streets of Minneapolis with these, you know, if we see what ICE is doing, you can see that what the U.S. does abroad has been slowly boomeranging back to the U.S. Domestically, kind of with ICE, with the kidnapping people off the streets, what we saw with those the pro-Palestinian students in the beginning of the Trump administration, how he, you know, how they sent those kidnapped those men and brought them to the CECOT prison, right? And so what I tried to do was take that same concept of the Imperial Boomerang, and I added the Imperial Health Boomerang. And the idea was to talk to other physicians, specifically to give them kind of a heads up what happened with Elon Musk and the doging of USAID and the cessation of PEPFAR. USAID and PEPFAR were incredible programs that we are already now upwards to seeing 500 deaths in about a year. And it's speculated that we are going to see somewhere deaths that are going to be numbered in the millions, of which, you know, 2/3 of them are likely to be children by 2030. Because people aren't getting their HIV medications or aren't getting their malaria medications, they aren't getting their TB medications. And so what we saw with the complete decimation of USAID and the complete decimation of PEPFAR, that is going to boomerang. That's the Imperial Health Boomerang that's going to boomerang back to the US. And with these cuts, right now, all the doctors that I know, all the healthcare providers, everybody's just kind of like, you know, buzzing along, just like it's, you know, every day is like a normal day. But those cuts are going to kick in. And when those cuts kick in, we need to have gone through the grieving process, because it's not then that we need to start grieving. It's now that we need to start grieving,
and
because
when do
we
they
need
kick?
To be ready. After the 2026 election, they kick in, of course, because they didn't want to
right.
happen before the 2026 elections, because they didn't want to be blamed for it. So they are slated to be kicked in likely in 2027, because it's going to be before the presidential elections. And what we are going to see is an enormous amount of pain. We're going to see it happen in rural areas. We're going to see rural hospitals close down. We are going to see it happen in nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities, because those are the areas that rely on Medicaid dollars.
And there's nothing blue or red about that constituency. That constituency is people. across the board. American citizens for sure, as well as some immigrants who are here legally. It sounds like it's a big audience that is potentially impacted.
100%. And this is something that is going to, again, right now, if we look at rural America is more likely to be red than it is to be blue. And so I think we are going to see a disproportionate amount of red America affected by these Medicaid cuts. And again, these were cuts that were then turned around and turned into tax cuts for the rich. So essentially, we are literally stealing from the poor to give to the rich. And then never mind the fact that we're spending $1 billion a day on a war in Iran. Not that if we weren't spending that money, that they would all of a sudden turn around and then just give it to the US population. I understand, I'm not foolish enough to know that that's how things work, but we are truly spending more and more monies away from the US population. And I think that it's about it would be smart for physicians to recognize that and to start the grieving process.
Mark Allen, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, we've been talking with Mark Allen Derry, and when we come back from a short break, Kathy's going to join me. We're going to switch gears and talk about Asian beetles. Asian longhorn beetles, and how these are a major threat that might be something we want to start paying attention to. Back in a minute with you on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Klipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Bold Iowa, Climate March, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, Circle of Peacemakers, and Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program. Kathy Burns with us, folks, for our farm and food conversation. And we're talking about a beautiful but nasty little beetle. Actually, a big beetle.
It's pretty big.
It's a big
it's
beetle.
Pretty big.
The Asian longhorned beetle.
Now, we heard about a threat to maple trees from a fellow that was here taking a tree down on our property.
An ash tree that had been destroyed by the emerald ash borer.
And that led us to the discussion of other threats to trees. And this new threat that we're going to talk about today is called the Asian longhorned beetle.
And longhorn is an adequate description. The antenna are more than the length of the body by a good bit.
They're actually...
I wish I had antenna like
they're
that.
They're kind of cool-looking bugs. I'd say they're about the length of my thumb in length. And then these long antenna that tend to be sort of... have little blue bits in them. And they are also sometimes called the starry night beetle because they're a black body with little white specks on it.
And I assume they're from Asia and they came here invasively.
Yes. And the areas that they are considered a real problem to enough to cause some quarantine of wood products are, they started in Brooklyn, New York, and went to Long Island, and then on to Massachusetts, Worcester County specifically, Ed, for you Massachusetts people, Ohio, and South Carolina.
Yeah, there's a really good video by an arborist in South Carolina showing how they're trying to control it, and they're actually doing a better job of controlling this than they did with the emerald ash borer, as far as I can tell.
Part of that is because the good news about these beetles is that as destructive as they are, once they get into a tree, they do not fly very much, and they cannot transport themselves very readily from county to county, from state to state. So they were probably brought here inside of some wood packaging from Asia, and that wood packaging began to be regulated in 2005. So now you have to, if you're going to use any wood packaging, you have to have it heat treated or fumigated to transport
And I
anything.
suppose if you were going to transport firewood, say from South Carolina to Tennessee,
Don't do it.
don't do it, especially if it's maple, because that might be housing one of these little devils.
Right. They are slow to spread, but they do cause a lot of destruction. So the way you can detect if you're seeing an Asian longhorn beetle or if you see signs of an infestation, when you see one, you well, I, everybody should just Google what they look like, and they're very distinctive. If you see one, try to catch it and put it into a secure jar and freeze it, because the people who are working on inspecting this want to
Freeze
confirm
it.
that. And how to detect an infestation. You will see round exit holes in tree trunks and branches about the size of a dime or smaller.
So big holes.
You'll see eggs that are oval or round wounds chewed into the bark, and you may see some sap weeping. You will see sawdust-like material called frass on the ground or around the
Frass.
trees.
Never heard of
It's
that.
kind of
Be a good Scrabble word.
what they bring out of the trees.
Yeah, so I mean, and we're here in Iowa. They're not even close to Iowa yet, but no matter where you are, even if you're in parts of South Carolina that haven't had this problem yet, you want to work with your local arborists and your USDA people to make sure they don't spread. We've been successful. For example, the Asian murder hornet, which is deadly to beehives, that has been effectively controlled. Like that came into the West Coast. The emerald ash borer has not been controlled. It just has it's been able to spread, probably because it can fly.
Well, what the USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services wants you to do, you're welcome to call arborists in your area, but they want you to contact them directly as soon as possible. There's a hotline for Asian longhorn beetle, the ALB hotline, and the phone number is 866-702-9938, or you can submit a report online at aphis.usda.gov.
And again, that phone number is 866-702-9938.
It's a good idea to photograph that beetle also, so that when you send your report in, and also photograph any damage that you believe may have come from that beetle.
And do they bite? Do we know this?
The fella who was in the video that you sent me, Ed, had one crawling around on his
Oh, he did.
hand,
That's right.
and it looked very docile. It almost looked kind of like a fun little pet.
It is a beautiful animal, actually.
It is very beautiful. So they won't, I don't know that they don't bite. But if I were going to catch one, I would wear gloves, or at least if I had a container to put it in, found one out on a walk somewhere, I would grab a big leaf of some other kind and scrape it from that surface of that tree or that leaf of the tree
And these
and put
kinds
it
of
in there.
Arboreal problems are not uncommon in our history. I mean, chestnut trees were wiped out in the U.S. We had, I can't remember which tree it was, there was a tree-lined street 100 years ago that was wiped out by something, and it was replaced by sycamores
Here in Des Moines.
In Des Moines. Yeah, I can't remember what it was now, but I mean, and it might have been chestnuts, in fact, but there have been problems with elm trees, and now this is the latest threat to maple trees in particular, which we consider very serious because we make maple syrup.
Maple trees and other hardwood
Right.
trees.
But it seems
And
like,
it won't really pay attention to a softwood tree.
right. For some reason, they seem to reference maple trees as the most endangered. I don't know why. Maybe that's the preferred diet of the Asian longhorn beetle.
Maybe they're sweet.
Maybe they're
You
sweet.
know,
Yeah, I
who
don't know.
knows?
But anyway, it's something to be taken serious and something we can actually do something about, especially if you're in the Northeast or the South Central, the Mid-Atlantic states. You know, those are the places where it's been a problem.
And folks, don't transfer that wood across state lines.
Yeah, don't do that. Yeah, no. Hey, Kathy, thanks for joining us. Thanks today to my guests, Leanna Elliott and Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Thanks to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Ditterman, Charles Goldman, and Kathy Burns. Thanks also to the Des Moines Iver Session for our bumper music. And many thanks to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks to our nonprofit partners, Circle of Peacemakers,
Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to you, our delightful audience, and to our monthly supporters. We'll be back next week with another hour of Cutting Edge Talk Radio.
So don't step on the bug. Probably needs a friend. Don't simply just hug. Really not a danger. So don't step on the bug.